CA shares with you the news of the day through a progressive lens. If you're curious about what's happening in Canadian politics, labor, the environment, and beyond, you've come to the right place. This is News for the Rest of Us. Thanks for tuning in. This week, we continue our conversation about the evolving landscape of education in Canada, this time in post-secondary education. Labour reporter Gabriella Kalugay-Kasuga sits down with David Robinson, Executive Director of the Canadian Association of University Teachers, to discuss the importance of academic freedom and why a strong, well-funded public post-secondary system is essential, not just for Canada's economy, but for the well-being of its society as a whole. Here are David Robinson and Gabriella Kalugay-Kasuga in conversation. Take a listen.
Hello, David. Thank you so much for joining us on Rabble Radio today.
That's my pleasure.
And just to start off, you know, we're coming into a new school year now. Could you tell us a bit about some of the issues that faculty at post-secondary institutions are facing on campus right now?
Well, the biggest issue that we're facing across the country is the financial crisis that's swept across almost every institution. We're seeing in Ontario about 10,000 layoffs in the college sector. We have a lockout strike at Dalhousie University right now. We're seeing job losses in British Columbia. It's a pretty bleak financial outlook facing both faculty and students right now.
Yeah, and can you tell me, you've mentioned, you know, the Dalhousie lockout and things like that. Can you tell me the impact that this has had on faculty and your working conditions?
Well, it's the old story of austerity is that faculty are being asked to do more and more with less and less. And ultimately, this is jeopardizing the quality of education that students are receiving. And so I think what's happening at Dalhousie, what's happening in contract negotiations at other universities across the country and colleges is faculty are trying to, as best they can, raise concerns about how the quality of education has really suffered because of lack of public funding. We've gone through a period where many provincial governments thought they could fund education on the cheap by enrolling and exploiting international students. Now that tap has been turned off. Now we're faced with what the underlying problem was, is that governments simply were not sufficiently funding public post-secondary education.
That's a really good point that you brought up about the international students specifically. What I've been hearing from the Canadian Federation of Students as well is that now that as you say, the tap has been turned off for international students, those fees are being pushed on to students that are already enrolled at universities or students who are enrolling from Canada. How has Scout been working with students to kind of address these issues? What kind of work is happening there?
Well, absolutely. I think we've been working for years with the Canadian Federation of Students and other student unions locally to try to make the case that public post-secondary education should be affordable, if not free, in terms of tuition fees in order to promote access and quality education. We can either pay for post-secondary education through prices or through taxes. And our position is it's much fairer to pay through it through a progressive tax system than it is through at the price point, where we've got, in many cases, in many provinces now, professional programs have been completely deregulated in terms of tuition fees. So to go to law school or medical school costs tens and tens of thousands of dollars now. That's a significant barrier for working class and middle class Canadians to send their kids to those places. But I also think, you know, when you have a system that's built on prices in terms of tuition fees, it also reshapes the institution in many ways so that the relationship between students and the institution is one of a client and a supplier. It becomes very, very commodified in terms of an exchange system rather than, you know, something that's supposed to build the individual and contribute to broader social good. It becomes much more of a transactional situation. So I think this raises some really fundamental problems as well. And it's reflected in the changing nature of work as well.
And I think that's a really interesting point that you've brought up about kind of this commodification of education. Can you tell me a bit more about how you're seeing that manifested and how people, you know, relate to work as well, as you just mentioned?
Well, it's led to an increasing kind of corporatization or managerial approach within universities. You know, one of the things that we've seen in terms of the academic workforce over the past 20 or 30 years has been the increasing casualization of the workforce, so that we have many more people who are faculty members who are actually receiving very modest incomes, struggling to get by, and not having any job security, or hired on contract by contract basis. And in some cases, people have been doing that for 15, 20 years now, working from contract to contract. So the same kind of gig economy that we've seen develop broadly is also infiltrated into post-secondary education. And part of the rationale for that is that when you look at this kind of casualization of the workforce, it's gone up, you know, whether funding's gone up or gone down. So it's been independent of funding in some ways. I think it's linked to the lack of public investment, but it's also linked to this issue of commodification, where institutions are looking for more flexibility to respond to market demands and changing shifts in student enrollments. So they don't want to make long-term commitments to faculty members who teach in, you know, philosophy or the arts or the humanities, recognizing that that may not be responsive to market needs in the near future.
Can you tell me a bit, you've mentioned social good earlier as well. Can you tell me how this gig economy, the lack of prioritization of some of these programs like humanities, I was actually a journalism and humanities major, so that hits very close to home for me, how that affects, you know, the social good and, you know, the kind of adults, I guess, that we are, you know, developing in these post-secondary institutions?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it sounds a bit antiquated, but one of the reasons, or one of the underlying objectives of education was to build the person, was not just to train people for the market or for the labor market or to get a job. That's certainly important, and I don't want to underemphasize that, but that's not the only thing that education is supposed to do. It's also supposed to help us understand how to live with one another, which I think we could certainly use a lot more of these days. It's also to help us understand ourselves and the world in which we live. Work isn't the only thing in our lives. In fact, it's probably not, shouldn't be the most important things in our lives. So that's the notion of a liberal education, liberal in that kind of broad sense, is being more and more displaced, I think, by a very economistic approach to what education should be. And you hear it a lot in terms of governments and even the federal Liberal government right now. During the election campaign, I think it was Pierre Poilievre who talked about, we need more boots and less suits. We need more sort of hands-on skills education and less ivory tower stuff. I think we need both. I don't think we should segregate people in that way. But unfortunately, I think we have a lot of governments now who are focusing on very, very short-term labor market outcomes. But I think education serves the broader public good when it increases social solidarity, cultural awareness, all kinds of things that aren't necessarily just that kind of short-term labor market outcome.
And you raise an interesting point as well of not wanting to separate, you know, the boots and suits. So I guess I have a follow-up question, kind of speaking to, you know, your role as an executive director in a labor organization, which is when you're developing people to become these workers, but you're not necessarily developing their, you know, the cultural awareness, the social solidarity, what does that do to the worker when they, you know, when they are faced with exploitation, when they are faced with these kinds of issues?
Well, I think it certainly limits people's horizons, but it also, I think, undermines the public good. I mean, I think there's absolutely, and many of our members teach in vocational education, absolutely important role for vocational education. But vocational education should also be broader than I think some people would like it to be. I often talk about a critical vocationalism. I mean, I think it'd be really important for workers who are being trained in engineering or welding or whatever to also understand the environmental impact of the work that they're doing, and to look at ways and how do we mitigate, given the existential crisis faced by climate change, how do we mitigate our impact on the environment through the work we do? I think that's vitally important for all workers to have an understanding of that. So I think we become a much poorer society if we try to segregate education and say, well, there's an elite education and they can deal with all the big problems, but workers should only learn how to do, you know, how to fix this widget and that's it. But I think work has to be conceived of much more broadly than that. We also often have to think about the environmental impact, the social impact, the social relations of work. And that requires, I think, this more critical vocationalism.
To me, on the issue of environment, for example, you know, as the environment worsens, that will also worsen working conditions for the worker. So when these aspects of education are being, you know, pushed aside or separated out, it sounds to me like it's also keeping the worker from fully understanding what is in their best interest when they try to organize. Would that be fair to say?
Absolutely, yeah. I think it atomizes work in some ways, and it sees it as separated from the social, environmental, cultural fabric in which it's actually built into. So I absolutely agree, yes.
I guess then sort of related, but I'm going to shift the conversation a little bit. I know another thing that your organization has been working a lot on is the issue of academic freedom. So can you tell me a bit more about what are the issues in this topic of academic freedom? What exactly is going on there?
Oh, there's always a lot going on in terms of academic freedom, but I guess I'd preface it to say that on a macro level, academic freedom is generally well respected in Canada. We don't have, certainly if you look south of the border right now, there are a lot of issues around academic freedom that haven't quite spilled over with the same intensity into Canada. I'm not saying we're immune, but that same level of intensity that we're seeing in the United States or in other jurisdictions around the world hasn't happened yet. I would say that the number one threat to academic freedom, in my view, goes back to what I said earlier, and that's the casualization of the academic workforce. And that is, for years, the procedural protection for academic freedom was the system of tenure, which was, after a rigorous evaluation process, you're essentially given a continuing appointment at an institution and can only be dismissed for just cause, which means the institution can't fire you because you say something unpopular or you challenge orthodoxy. But if you're on a contract, the institution doesn't need to fire you. They just simply don't renew your contract. So without that procedural protection, I think a lot of academics are exposed potentially to serious infringements of academic freedom. So I think that's obviously the number one issue. I think most recently, the issue of academic freedom has been put into the spotlight because of concerns about how some institutions have handled cases of academics speaking out on the Palestine-Israel conflict right now. And certainly after October 7th, 2023, there was a flurry of cases that erupted in Canada, but also globally. In fact, there was a statement issued by the UN Special Rapporteurs on Human Rights, who were calling for states to more vigorously defend freedom of speech in the context of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And we saw a little bit of that in Canada, but not nearly to the same extent as in the United States, but we do see it here. And we have had to handle a couple of cases over that period.
And so it sounds like, yeah, there's two aspects that are really threatening academic freedom right now. And I'm curious, what does that, you know, mean for, you know, public discourse, public opinion, when there are these threats to academic freedom?
Yeah, I think, and I'd also say that it's not just academic freedom. I mean, we also saw journalists who ran afoul of employers over the period. We saw a whole number of potential speech advocates who were faced with repercussions because of what they had said or what they had posted on social media or whatever. So I think that's certainly an issue. And I think the other element of threats to academic freedom, again, what we're seeing really quite concentrated in the United States is this rise of an authoritarianism. And we see a little bit of that here in Canada, again, not to the same extent, but we've seen governments, the government of Alberta last year proposed legislation that would have given it the authority to vet research funding given to academics to ensure it was aligned with their political priorities. Again, I think that's a classic authoritarian playbook, is trying to control the kinds of research that academics do. So research, for instance, that's critical of the oil and gas industry in Alberta, might not be welcomed by that provincial government. But we also saw it more recently in Nova Scotia. Bill 12 that was passed by the Nova Scotia provincial government gives the minister the authority to impose a program reorganization on universities. So this kind of political interference directly into what kinds of programs institutions are being offered. Now, this appears mild, perhaps, in light of what's happening in the United States, where the Trump administration has essentially blackmailed institutions into shutting down programs and paying the U.S. government huge fees. But I do worry that that kind of authoritarian tendency, the sense that governments want more and more control of what's taught or researched, is something we have to be very aware of and be absolutely steadfast in opposing.
Can you tell me a bit more about, you know, what are some of the risks if we are not vigilant when we see these supposedly mild cases come up?
Well, I think it's basically a fundamental threat to institutional autonomy. In all advanced higher education systems around the world, the principle of institutional autonomy is absolutely sacrosanct because it allows for the academic community to determine what should be taught, how it should be taught, and what should be researched. When you have governments trying to meddle in that, they almost always get it wrong, but it also suppresses academic freedom because it prevents scholars from pursuing what they think is scientifically interesting or intellectually interesting versus what the government thinks should be a priority. We saw in the former Soviet Union how science atrophied over time because there was too much government control. So this notion of institutional autonomy is essentially, a foundation for academic freedom. It's absolutely critical to allow for academics to pursue knowledge in the public interest.
I want to kind of take it back to an example that you had shared a bit earlier and kind of unpack this situation in the light or through the lens of academic freedom. You mentioned Dalhousie faculty are locked out right now. This is the first major research university to lock out its academic staff. So given that context, what impact does this situation have on academic freedom?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure there's a direct impact. I think it's more of a labor dispute that we're seeing because of years of austerity. But I also think coming out of the pandemic, we experienced more strikes in a 1 year period than we had in the previous 10 years combined, it seems, because I think there was a lot of frustration that had developed amongst faculty across the country that during the pandemic, we had to pivot to teaching online. It was often done with little support. It was time consuming. So faculty were putting in more hours under more stress. Students were under stress. Students needed more attention. So workloads went up. And then coming out of the pandemic, we didn't even get a pat in the back for that. And we were told now, well, this is the new normal. So now you're going to have to continue this workload. So I think a lot of faculty were just frustrated by this. And so a lot of contract negotiations hit an impasse, and we saw a number of strikes. I don't think, in most cases, academic freedom hasn't been something that we've seen come up at the bargaining table. Here and there it does a little bit, but by and large, I think Canada is relatively unique in that there's a fairly decent consensus. I wouldn't say it's 100%, but there's a fairly decent consensus between faculty unions and administrations about what academic freedom is. I think there's stumbling blocks here and there, but by and large, we don't see the same kind of violations of academic freedom that we see certainly in the United States or in other parts of the world right now.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I'm curious, though, as well, because you had mentioned earlier that with the rising of contractualization at universities, that also affects academic freedom for, staff who maybe aren't necessarily on contract, but are dealing with these poor working conditions that are, galvanizing people to strike. Is that affecting at all, retention of, people who are maybe more likely to be researching into these academic topics that maybe could be, unpopular or might be repressed in a more authoritarian situation?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's certainly... I think it's the case that the academic profession has lost a little bit of its luster over the years. I mean, I'm old enough to remember that this used to be considered a very very plum job. I mean, this was something that people aspire to. But I hear a lot of people now, a lot of my own members say, you know, I'm advising my graduate students that you might not want to get a job in a university or college right now, that the working conditions have deteriorated so much, that the workload has become unsustainable. We've moved from a system in which we had a lot of faculty voice over terms and conditions and also over the way in which we taught to more and more control by the central administration, by governments, as we mentioned earlier. So I think there's that loss of professional autonomy, that loss of shared governance in the institution that had been a hallmark of higher education previously. So I think the overall conditions have become less attractive. For contract academic staff, you know, it's a very difficult position to be in, because in many cases, contract academic staff have to work at several institutions. We often call them the Rhodes Scholars, right? They have to move from one institution to the other in order to get to piece together enough contracts to make a decent living. But even for the full-time faculty, those who are tenured, there's an impact, because when you have more and more contract staff, you have less continuity. But you have more administrative work falls on to the fewer remaining full-time faculty. So it does have an impact on everyone. And I think one of the things that we've seen over the past 20 years has been virtually every contract academic faculty in the country has now been certified in a trade union because of the need to have a stronger collective voice over their terms and conditions of employment.
It shows just how intensified the struggle has been that people are now unionizing more. I'm curious also, how has these worsening working conditions affected the education that students receive?
Yeah, well, I think students are, you know, obviously paying a lot more for larger class sizes, for fewer course offerings. We've seen massive cancellations in programs across the country right now. So you have fewer options, you're paying more money. My members are doing their best, but they're also, you know, they're swamped. So that kind of level of attention may not be there as it was in the past. And I think students rightly are becoming more and more unhappy with the quality of education that they're getting. Not because my members aren't doing their best, but because the experience of being in very large classes, having fewer options is starting to take its toll. I think it goes back again to the question. The fundamental problem we have is we have decided somewhere along the way that we were not going to fund post-secondary education appropriately. We initially began shifting the costs on individual students. Then for a while, we thought, well, we'll just soak it to international students and that'll backfill the lack of public funding. I think we have a system that is now fundamentally broken. And we have to figure out, do we have the political will to decide post-secondary education is important and we need to fund it adequately? And that has to happen both at the provincial and federal level. Right now, unfortunately, I don't see the political will, but I think we're shooting ourselves in the foot, because every advanced economy knows, and I don't want to frame it solely in economic arguments, but there is a strong economic argument to be made that a robust, independent, autonomous, well-funded post-secondary education system is absolutely vital to helping us not just economically, but also solve some of the major crises we're facing right now, let alone issues like climate change.
I guess to kind of wrap up this discussion then, for people who are listening, who are hearing this, who do value post-secondary education, who want to support students and faculty in their struggle for quality post-secondary education, what can people do to show that support?
Well, we have to organize. We have to come together, and we have to create the political will. It's, you know, Mark Carney's not going to wake up tomorrow morning and say, "Oh, I forgot about universities and colleges." We have to make the case. We have to make the argument. We have to come together. We have to find one another, and we have to voice our concerns. I think anything that people can do to show solidarity, for instance, with the faculty at Dalhousie, that this is a fight for quality public education. Go out, join the picket lines. Let's talk to each other, and let's figure out a way in which we can move the political dial in this country. Because frankly, you know, we don't have much of a future if we don't have a strong, robust, independent post-secondary education system.
David Robinson, thank you so much for joining us on Rabble Radio today.
My pleasure.
That was David Robinson and Gabriella Kalugay-Kasuga in conversation. Thanks so much for that, David and Gabby. Switching gears now, this is our In Case You Missed It segment, where we review the top stories from this week on Rabble.ca. To do that, let's turn things over to Rabble editor Nick Seabrook. Over to you, Nick.
Thanks, Brianne. Starting this week with national news. The House of Commons returns next week to what has already been a busy start to September in the world of politics. Last week, the federal NDP officially kicked off their race to find a new leader. In his latest article on Rabble, parliamentary reporter Carl Nirenberg argues that the NDP need to make a stronger effort to ensure that their next leader is bilingual in French and English. While no candidate has yet officially filed to enter the race, Nirenberg speculates that sitting MP Heather McPherson and filmmaker and activist Avi Lewis are expected to launch their campaigns at some point in the near future. Neither of those candidates have a very strong grasp of the French language. Nirenberg argues that it is important for national leaders to be bilingual. Nearly one in five Canadians speaks French to some degree. The leaders of all the other federal parties are bilingual, and an ability to speak French has long been considered one of the qualifying criteria to be a national leader. According to Nirenberg, picking a future leader who is not able to speak an acceptable amount of French would be political malpractice for the NDP. In labor news, Air Canada flight attendants overwhelmingly rejected a tentative deal with their employer. The flight attendants, who are represented by the Canadian Union of Public Employees, voted over 99% in favor of rejecting the offer. The main reason for rejecting the offer, the union said, was because the pay increases offered still fell below the federal minimum wage, which is $2,840 per month on a 40-hour work week. Under the tentative agreement, full-time Rouge flight attendants would have earned $2,219 per month, and a full-time flight attendant for Air Canada's main line would earn $2,522 per month. Both sides had agreed prior to the union voting on the deal that should it be rejected, that there would be no further work disruptions, and that both sides would send the matter to mediation. And finally, join us for the return of the Off the Hill webinar series on Tuesday, September 16th. In this new episode, Rabble's political panel discusses the return of the House of Commons on Monday and the priorities of the labor movement. Appearing on the panel for this episode are Rabble's parliamentary reporter Carl Nirenberg, researcher and activist Chuka Ejekam, Ontario Federation of Labor President Laura Walton, and former Ontario NDP MPP and former federal NDP candidate Joel Hardin. Join us on September 16th at 7:30 p.m. Eastern, 4:30 p.m. Pacific. Visit rabble.ca to register today. And as always, you can read about all the stories we talked about today on rabble.ca.
Thanks, Nick. And that's it for Rabble Radio this week. If you like the show, please consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you to all the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nirenberg for supplying the music. I'm Brianne Doyle, and I'll talk to you next week. Thank you.
from Burnaby.